Though the spirit and the flesh are one, we do not always attend to them equally. I certainly do not. I have a long-standing joke that the part of me that gets a great workout every single day is my spirit. Humbleness, patience, courage, resilience, reflection, prayer, community, solitude, ministry is a serious workout. If my body looked like my spirit does, I would look like J-Lo. While I take better care of my body than I sometimes have, this is always going to be what progressives like to call a growing edge for me. Yet while it's not one of my strengths, it's better than it used to be, because for a while it was pretty bad, and I didn't even care that it was pretty bad. It was just part of how life went for me when I was on and off bulimic for about 10 years. It is a strange thing to contemplate how many ways there are to choose to hurt yourself, and how often we do choose to hurt ourselves. Because we're tired of being good, or being careful, or being predictable, or because we're angry and ready to act out and show it, even if it will cost us whatever. Because we're hurting, and we cannot stand it anymore. To punish ourselves because we are unhappy with how we look or how we are or how we feel, because we have been taught to be unhappy or ashamed about how we look or how we are or how we feel. There is both shame and seduction in addiction. Even though in recent years, counter movements have arisen to affirm people in this country as we are, whether we're gay or large or trans or skinny or dark or light or book smart or artistic, every combination of ways that we are. And still, we all know that living is painful, and sometimes because of a painful reality that no one can change, too often because someone chooses to diminish another in order to puff themselves up. We know people make that ugly choice every day. At our worst, we make that ugly choice. Sometimes because we are lashing out in response to our own pain. We all know the pain of living, of being hurt by rejection or condemnation, of being afraid for ourselves or for our loved ones in the world, losing those we love. We know what it is to feel a void inside ourselves. Something is missing, or lonely, or anxious, or wrong that we may not even be able to name any better than that. Maybe no name really names it, but we feel it. And we know what it is to be so assailed by the world that we have to have something to protect us from the pain and vulnerability that living involves. This is like the torment in that song that's on the radio still a lot, Alessia Cara's Scars to Your Beautiful. She has dreams to be in envy, so she's starving. You know, cover girls eat nothing. She says, beauty is pain, and there's beauty in everything. What's a little bit of hunger? I could go a little while longer. She fades away. She don't see her perfect, she don't understand she's worth it, or that beauty goes deeper than the surface. So to all the girls that's hurting, let me be your mirror, help you see a little bit clearer the light that shines within. And you don't have to change a thing, the world could change its heart. There are so many ways to hurt yourself when we choose to do it. And when we choose to do it, the perverse relief of it, the release of it. This is what brings us back to it again and again, the seduction of that effect, the easing of pain, the self-medication, the escape, the secret stairway we return to again and again until it becomes no longer an escape, but a prison, a way of life. And especially now in these days of fentanyl and heroin, a way of death. While some of the ways of hurting ourselves may look very different on the outside, they have, I think, a strange resonance. Having never cut myself, I can imagine what it might be like feeling that relief and that release that cutters describe, because I remember that feeling from the many years that I was actively bulimic. I struggled with bulimia from when I was 13, well into my 20s. At its worst, I would throw up, or try to, every single thing that went into my mouth, because eating anything at all felt like I had ingested poison. I would panic and be desperate, and all I could think about was getting it back out of me, out of my body, immediately. Whatever I ate or didn't, I was thinking of my body and how horrible it was. And whenever I looked in the mirror or went to a restaurant or passed a reflecting store window or got dressed or got undressed, I thought of it. And I remember how overwhelming it was to try to fight this. How could I fight these insidious and humiliating feelings and behaviors that go along with an eating disorder? Once when I was in high school, I wrote a short story about bulimia, and I let it be published with my name on it in the school literary magazine. And I did this because I hoped that once it was public, it would cease to be my private hell. And in being no longer secret, it would somehow be neutralized, change from a vital thing to a shadow, detach from me and fade into the distance of time past. Needless to say, this did not happen. Throughout those years I was bulimic, I was usually not thin, but I actually also wasn't fat. My weight's gone up and down my whole life. I'm currently in an up phase that I'm starting a diet on and exercise. But I look back at pictures from those earlier days and I am amazed because I see a girl who looked good. She had maybe a few pounds to lose, but she didn't look bad at all, and a girl who, in fact, sometimes was quite slim. My distorted perception was very typical. Hilda Brook, a leader in the field of eating disorders, wrote about a girl with anorexia nervosa who literally could not see differences between photos of herself at 15 years and a healthy weight and 17 years with her weight down to 70 pounds. The girl said, quote, "I feel inwardly that I am larger than that, no matter what I tell myself. Even when I was at my lowest, 67 pounds, I felt that I was very large." A lot of people who suffer in this way are aware of our skewed perspective, but this awareness can actually contribute to feeling helpless or pathetic or fundamentally off balance around food and weight and body appearance and selfhood generally. So this sermon isn't just about bulimia or eating disorders in general. It is about disorders and addictions that take many forms, that are a hidden pain and shame to those who struggle with them, and frightening and confounding to loved ones who only encounter it second or third hand. There's been a lot of research into what causes people to react to life and food or alcohol or drugs this way, and there are lots of theories. And there is no single definitional reason yet. It could be mothers or fathers or siblings or peer pressure or advertising or puberty or societal structures and pressures, genetics. Some researchers think it's a combination of those factors. There's some evidence of a psychobiological connection. There is a strong correlation between the trauma of being physically, sexually, or emotionally abused and people developing one of these disorders. Also, a correlation between such abuse and cutting in particular and some other addictive behaviors, but abuse is not always part of an addicted person's history. And there are cultural dimensions to different addictions and how they manifest. Studies have also found that when it comes to eating disorders, anorexia does not exist at all in countries where there is still danger of widespread starvation or famine. In other words, self-starvation is observed only under long-term conditions of adequate or abundant food supply. The connection between food and life for people in some countries is very different than it is for most of us here. There they eat to live. And here, most of us insulated from the worst of the world's suffering, we may live to eat, or live to starve, or to drink, or seek to disengage from life altogether. There are no absolute fail-safe cures for eating disorders or for any self-destructive addiction. There are 12-step and other recovery programs and treatment and retreat centers and counseling that comes in many forms, and some of these work some of the time. But in many ways, addiction is still mysterious. And despite being a mystery rooted in the body, there is a spiritual aspect of this that I think is too often overlooked. Unitarian Universalist minister Marilyn Sewell wrote in an introduction to her book, Cries of the Spirit, quote, "We in this country spend an inordinate amount of time attempting to control our bodies. Objectified, surveyed, judged, our flesh is seen as an instrument, as a means to various and sundry ends." Think about that. The body as a means, which makes it somehow separate rather than part of us, discontinuous with the soul or the psyche, rather than one self. This breakdown, this separation of body and soul is certainly present for people with eating disorders. Their minds obsessed with a body they cannot honor. But I think it exists pervasively in the world of addictions. There is a foundational disconnect that happens deep within, damage inflicted by a person or a teaching or a society that can drive right to our hearts, right to our souls, and make us riven, splitting us from ourselves, our minds from our bodies, our goodness from our worth, so that we can become gluttons for our doom in countless ways. Now, I am not trying to say that this is how every person struggling or dealing with an addiction feels or experiences. Humankind is far too diverse for any absolutes. But I am saying that I know I have felt it, that many I have spoken with or worked with about their addictions have felt this disconnect, this severing that goes along with a kind of void. And a lot of people with eating disorders say that at some point they stop being able to tell if they were hungry. Think about that. That's like the first thing we figure out when we're babies, right? If the baby is crying, they're hungry. Because some babies don't mind a dirty diaper. But every baby minds being hungry. They stop being able to tell if they were hungry. Hunger had little to do with when or why they did or didn't eat. They ate to fill a different kind of emptiness. One woman who worked with Dr. Brooks said she was, quote, "afraid of the hostility of others, and their angry words would rattle around inside her and keep on wounding her. But by stuffing herself with food, she would cover her sore inside like a poultice, and she would not feel the hurt so much." And others speak of eating to just stuff down the pain of living or to feel a void they feel inside themselves, buffer themselves against the world. Change out eating for drinking or shooting up or cutting. And the model still, often, terribly, holds. And religions have been both a curse and a blessing in this. Because too often religions have contributed to the splitting, have lifted up the soul at the expense of the body, have told us that it's only when we ignore or condemn or mortify the body that we achieve goodness or sacredness. But also, religions have taught us to value the body and hold it as sacred, to celebrate the body, and to use the body for celebration. I think part of the reason that 12-step programs like Alcoholics Anonymous and others have some of the strongest records of success with addiction is because all 12-step programs incorporate spirituality into their model. At their best, spirituality and the communal form, which is organized religion, are all about responding to both the sublime and the grievous in life in integrated ways, giving both the body and the soul ways to walk through what lifts us highest or slams us hardest. At their best, theology and traditions and rituals offer supportive ways to respond body and soul together to the experiences and challenges of living, of birth, of emerging sexuality, of maturing, of encountering nature in all its forms, of encountering other human beings in relationship to self, of offering or experiencing blessing, of aging, and of dying. And while addictions are honest responses to pain, they are responses that require a canceling out of self and spirit and life. Imperfection and suffering are part of being human for every one of us, but they are not the whole of being human for any one of us. And the importance or beauty or power of our lives will never be determined by the ways we suffer, but by the ways we heal. By the ways that we heal. Healing. So often the knitting together not only of flesh but also of spirit, not just a recovery but a reconciliation in order for life to be lived and not just endured. Part of our healing has to allow grace. Unearned, unforceable grace, its place. Grace that helps us be strong in a moment when we're usually weak. Grace that puts a person, a mentor, a sponsor, a friend, a family member right where we need them, when we need them most. Grace that allows us to speak a truth instead of lies. Grace that allows us to hear truth, including that we are beautiful and worthy, full of value, always with a life we may shape, a recovery that can be ours, another way to contend with what hurts us. This is what I had to learn to finally be done with bulimia. It took me a long time to come to terms with being worthy, with being lovable, with what, in fact, my religion had been teaching me my whole life, yet which nonetheless felt almost always only like a principle, which is, after all, what we call it, a principle, rather than a reality. A principle is something abstract, something lofty, something we try to live up to. A principle can exist as a principle even when it is actually only a rebuke to the reality on the ground. So yes, I knew our Unitarian Universalist first principle, the inherent worth and dignity of every human being. But for so long, I never for a moment associated that with myself. In which case, what use is it? You know that old saying, you cannot love another person until you love yourself? This was not that. At least it was not that for me. Because I saw a lot of people I respected and even revered who seemed absolutely full of inherent worth and dignity to me. Beauty and preciousness. I just couldn't see it in myself. And if I did, it was much more in the spirit and not in the flesh. So, from the path I have walked and what I have learned and what I am still learning, let me this morning be your mirror and help you see a little bit clearer the light that shines within. Because I think part of the problem was that in the church I grew up in, which was a wonderful congregation and still is, but people didn't say it a lot to each other, what that inherent worth and dignity of every individual actually must mean for the people in the pews, and not just as an impetus to social justice, which it also is. I have said before, the great thing about this ginormous pulpit is that it offers such great sight lines. From down there, I can't see everybody in the back, and I can't see everybody in the balconies, but when I'm up here, I see all of you. I see all of you. Every single one who's here. And I know many of you now. So I can tell you, seeing you and knowing so many of you, that the spirit and the flesh are one and beautiful in all your forms. Each and every one of you. Against the ugly and diminishing and marketing and classist, racist, ageist, sexist, and sexualized messages that society and corporations and tyrants send us every minute of every day, we have a faith and a faith community that declares an entirely different gospel. One that says beauty is in you and upon you. And yes, inherent worth and dignity. That you are full of power and goodness. That you need no product or court ruling to make you a worthy person, or friend, or sister, or brother, or sibling, or parent, or lover, or partner, or spouse. Even if your soul is suffering, even if you are hurt or lonely, even if you are sitting here today desperate or exhausted or angry or afraid or cranky, your scars that mark your healing, your challenges that balance your gifts, you, your skin, your hips, your shoulders, your belly, your feet, your skin with acne or age spots, and your hot, bald head. And your beautiful eyes that need glasses. And your hair that never looks the way you want it to. You, from your possibly painted toes to your possibly dyed hair, are beautiful. Wholeheartedly, from my flawed self to yours. This is part of our promise that we must affirm again and again. We are here to nourish and cherish and encourage each other in all shapes and sizes and colors and ages and heritages that we hold, towards all the goodness and wisdom that we can possibly achieve, which we can only achieve together. This is why we have to be open to sharing our struggles and pain with each other and believing in the power of love and care in this faith community to hold us and help us, because we are each sacred and spirit-infused, even as we are human and fallible. Imperfection is part of our existence, and it is okay. It's okay. Let us not punish ourselves or our spirits for it, especially not in this day and age when our spirits are already punished enough, people. Let us not anesthetize our spirits with food or alcohol or drugs or work or even prizes and awards. There is nothing that cannot be faced, overcome, accepted, or healed. Make room for grace so that when it comes, you are open. Get out in nature right now when it is so cold and hard and see all that lives, even in the coldness and hardness of the season. Notice when nature speaks to you of endurance and cycles and new life and the possibilities that come with change. Move your body and spend time doing what brings you joy or with people who love you. The real you. Face the questions or memories that haunt you and let others help you face them. Seek answers and honor them when you find them. Require respect and offer it back. Lean on others when you need to without shame or arrogance. These are tools for living, not just for surviving, but for thriving. If the spirit suffers, so will the body. If the body rejoices, so will the spirit. They share fatigue, exhilaration, depression, surprise, love. The flesh is not unholy. The flesh is not even just a vessel for the holy. The flesh is holy as the soul is holy, as the self is holy, as you are holy. Let your embodied life show all the power and goodness that are inherently yours. Yours to care for. And yours to share. Amen.